the House Judiciary Committee for Thursday, March 15th, 2007. Just to indicate to those in the room how we're going to proceed, we're going to leave the work session over until after the public hearings have been held. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2448 for purposes of accommodating a couple of the legislative sponsors of the bill and a constituent who is affected by that bill. And then we're going to close that public hearing and open the public hearing on, or I should say recess that public hearing or close it temporarily, and then go to a public hearing on House Bill 2909, because that's the bill of the broader, more general impact. So it would be a more logical development of the issues. So with that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2448. Councilor Kelmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2448 establishes a four-year statute of limitations in product liability or negligence actions for injuries and a six-year statute of limitations in actions for death if the action is based on an injury caused by a COX-2 inhibitor. The bill provides that the statute of limitations in these actions begins to run when the plaintiff discovers or should have discovered the causal relationship between the injury and the product or the causal relationship between the injury and the conduct of the defendant. HB 2448 establishes that these actions are not subject to any statute of ultimate repose, and the bill applies to actions arising before and after the date of passage of the bill.
Thank you, Council. I'd like to invite Representatives Jensen and Smith forward, and with their with a constituent who's accompanying Representative Smith. Oh, and while they're coming forward, I should explain for people in the room who are not wouldn't be aware. We're under reduced lighting in the room today for the comfort of some people who are here today who have been injured by exposure to light rays and an incident actually that occurred within my district at Bryant Elementary School, and have a particular interest in the second bill that we're going to hear on the statute of ultimate repose. So just so you understand that that's the reason why we've got a little dimmer lighting than we ordinarily have. Mm-hmm. Representatives.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Patty Smith. I represent Hood River County, East Multnomah, and East Clackamas County, and I'm here today to urge your support of House Bill 2448. And with me, I have the co-sponsor, Representative Bob Jensen, and Pat Rowan, who the chair indicated has been affected by this, what we're doing the bill for. So I think I'll just turn it over to her. She's driven a long way. She came from Hood River County to tell you her story, and I think it's instrumental in what we decide to do, unless Representative Jensen wants to go first.
No, please, have her.
Okay. Thank you.
Please identify yourself.
Honorable Representatives, my name is Patricia Rowan. I am a recently retired English teacher from Hood River Valley High School. I'm here to request your help to redress a grievance. In my dictionary, the first three definitions of redress are defined as setting right that which is wrong or repairing a wrong. The fourth definition is to correct or reform abuses and evils. Last year, Senate Bill 1011 was shelved. This bill would have allowed Vioxx victims and their families to sue Merck, the manufacturer of Vioxx, within 2 years of their injury or within 2 years of the date they first learned of the likely cause of their strokes or heart attack. My husband began taking Vioxx in the early part of 2001. My husband, Clyde Rowan, died on May 21st, 2002. It is not possible to repair the wrong. During the spring break, the last week of March 2002, my husband and I were walking in the Redwoods in California. 2 weeks later, he suffered a transitory stroke. He was speaking gibberish. The hospital ran tests and explained that a transitory stroke can be caused by a tiny particle breaking loose. His speech returned. His heart was excellent, but we were told that tests had determined that my husband had suffered a puzzling silent heart attack. My husband seemed totally recovered, but the doctor decided to keep him in the hospital overnight for observation. The next morning, my son and I picked Clyde up from the hospital, and in the car he suffered another stroke. We went to an emergency ward. They ran tests to see if his brain was bleeding. No bleeding was found. No test could determine why my husband was stroking. The only drugs my husband had been taking were Lipitor and Vioxx. Within the week, my husband suffered a massive stroke, and another stroke, and another stroke. My husband was a lion of a man, and for the first time in 31 years, I saw him afraid. Within a few weeks, he suffered so many strokes, I lost track of him. Dr. Stelzer told me that an MRI showed that my husband had many, many black dots on his brain. Each black dot was a mini stroke. Once the strokes began to impact Clyde, each stroke took something from him. He couldn't walk. He became blind. Right after strokes, he couldn't talk. He lost his memory. He became like a little boy. He sometimes remembered our children, but he couldn't remember that they had married. One stroke affected his ability to swallow. The hospital had pronounced my husband a code blue. They said we shouldn't bring him back anymore because they couldn't help him. The doctor at the emergency ward said that his body had declared itself. That was the diagnosis. My husband was assigned to hospice. I struggled to feed him with an eyedropper to keep him from starving. And during this time, I once even had Vioxx made in liquid form so that I could get it down him. The hospice nurses said my husband suffered neural agitation. He didn't sleep. He fought to get up. He fought to get hold of things to pull himself up. Days blended into nights, and I slept for minutes here and minutes there. My daughter Mary and our sons Guy and Joseph helped as much as they could. And one night I was lying on the couch, and he became quiet, and he said, "Patty, I'm dying." And I could only cry, because it's lucidity and madness, as Shakespeare called it. Nobody seemed to know why he was stroking. Dr. Keith Stelzer looked at his test results and said that sometimes we couldn't find a cause. My husband was in pain. Some of you may know of an existentialist painting called The Scream. I always thought the face in the painting was startling and terrible. But I honestly have a new vision of horror, my husband's face. Hospice put my husband in the hospital around May 10th to get his pain under control. His veins had collapsed in his arms. They threaded tubes through his toes, and they did not feed him. They gave him water intravenously. After a few days, they stopped giving him any water. Clyde Rowan died less than 2 months after we had walked in the redwoods because we dehydrated him to death. I watched the blue of his eyes deflate and bulge out like a flat tire. It took 11 days, I think, to kill the strong, good man. The newspapers in his hometown in California and in our adopted town of Hood River paid tribute to his honesty, his goodness, and his courage to fight for right. I am grateful for the numbness that happened to my body and my brain that first year after Clyde died. Even with the numbness, I wanted to climb into the grave with him. I still, as you can see, deeply grieve the loss of my husband. The most difficult part of everything was trying to understand why. I'm basically a rationalist. Cause and effect, action and reaction. I was listening to the news in September of 2004, and I heard that Vioxx had been withdrawn from the market because it had been associated with strokes and heart attacks. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. I knew why my husband had begun stroking. As I read reports, it became clear that Merck had not only was aware of the connections between their drug and strokes and heart attacks, but had suppressed the reports. It became clear to me that Merck recklessly and willfully had a hand in my husband's death. I am not here to argue that point. I'm here to argue for the right to sue Merck. I cannot repair the wrong done to my husband, to my family, or to me. I can only hope to reform the abuse. I believe that this giant company has demonstrated that good conscience and ethical judgment will fall prey to greed and deceit. Therefore, we, the citizens of this country and of this state, must have the right to petition the government for redress of grievance, as guaranteed by the First Amendment, which includes the right to file suit in a court of law. Last year, the Oregon legislature took away my fundamental right to sue Merck by shelving HB 1011. please reconsider an updated bill that will add the last time. I'm sorry, I didn't know about the new bill that you were introducing this morning. The ability to sue Merck is the only way that I have to attempt to reform the abusers, because sadly, it is apparent that some companies who hold our lives in their hands will only pay attention to money. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Rowan. I know how difficult this is for you to come, and we appreciate your describing the tragedy that had happened in your family, and it really helps us as policymakers to see the human dimension to the issues that come before us. Are there any questions from the committee for anybody on this panel? Thank you very much for coming, and particularly coming such a long way.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I'm State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58, which consists of most of Umatilla County. In 1982, I was teaching at Blue Mountain Community College, where I, at that time, hired a young man to come to work in the department that I was head of. As will happen in especially small schools, I spent the next 10 years, interacting with this person, and we became friends. I retired in 1993 and lost track of my friend Cal Army by name. It was only in the last session of the legislature that I renewed that acquaintance, when he was down here to lobby for the companion bill, or the bill that we had in the last session on this. I don't want to even try to present a case that it's similar to, but it maybe isn't as compelling, depending on one circumstances, I guess, with that. But as the testimony you've already heard this morning, but a very similar story. Cal was in a wheelchair when he came to the state capitol to lobby for this bill in that session, and the only explanation for strokes that he had had were multiple strokes that he'd had were Vioxx as a medicine. He too was a very active, healthy, strong, energetic, enthusiastic, bright, intelligent person. And it was somewhat devastating, I guess, put it mildly, for me to see what had happened. Sorry Mr. Larmy can't be here or isn't here to testify before you, but I would plead with the committee to simply allow people who may have been, and I'm not even going to say were, but just simply may have been, the victims of this drug, the right and opportunity to seek a redress in front of a court of law, where a jury of people just like you and I can, after hearing the case, make the determination as to who's right and who's wrong, and what, if any, further action should be taken. So I simply ask you to seriously consider this bill, and ask you to move it forward through this process. And thank you very much, Chairman McPherson for the opportunity and privilege of testifying in front of your committee here this morning and to members of the committee. We will conclude with that and entertain if you have any questions that I can answer for you, though I do not in any way pretend to be an authority, medical authority nor legal authority, so I'm out of my league in both regards. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Are there any questions? And thank you very much to all three of you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
I will now close the temporary public hearing on House Bill 2448 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2909. Our first signed up witness is Richard Lane.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to testify in favor of House Bill 2909. House Bill 2909 repeals what's known as the ultimate repose statute in a products liability action. And the best way to sort of explain what an ultimate repose statute is to give you an example. Almost all of you may have a washing machine in your houses. The washing machine was bought some 8 years ago. If your child or grandchild is injured as a result of a defect in that washing machine and that injury occurs, 7 years, 364 days after it was purchased, you can maintain a civil action against that manufacturer, against them for that defect and the injury that resulted. Under the same circumstances, if that same injury to that child or grandchild around that washing machine, subject to the same defect, that injury occurs 8 years and 1 day after that product was first bought, you're barred from proceeding with any type of claim. That's the ultimate repose statute that you have in Oregon. It's 49th out of 50 states as the most restrictive statute of ultimate repose in a products action. Only North Carolina, at 6 years, is more restrictive. Materials that I handed up to you include a chart that shows basically 40 states have no ultimate repose statute at all, allowing their citizens redress in the courts if they're injured as a result of a defective product. A couple of others have what's called a useful life exception. I think one actually looks to the ultimate repose statute of the place of manufacturing. The ultimate repose statute bars individuals from seeking any type of redress or access to the courts for their injuries. Over the years, numerous exceptions and what I call carve-outs have been passed by the legislature. Claims having to do with asbestos injuries, claims having to do with breast implants, claims having to do with exploding side saddle gas tanks. Whenever a situation arises and the individuals have a compelling case, they bring their concern to you, and if in your wisdom believe that a carve-out should be passed, you do. You've just heard some compelling testimony regarding the Vioxx situation. I know we have some witnesses here today, as Chair McPherson identified, that have a compelling story to tell you about injuries that they suffered that they cannot seek any recovery for because of the ultimate repose statute. House Bill 2909 would repeal the ultimate repose statute. I think it's far and away high time that Oregon got in step with at least 40 of the other states in the union. We think it's fair. We think it allows individuals that are injured to pursue a claim for damages, thereby spreading the cost of their own injuries around, unlike they're prohibitive now. They're absorbed inside of health care costs and workers' comp claims that third-party injuries cannot be pursued. We think it's a good bill, and we'd ask your passage of 2909. And I'll take any questions from Chair McPherson or the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Are there questions from the committee? Mr. Lane, it might be helpful to the committee, and actually helpful to me since it's not an area in which I practice, to have the statute of ultimate repose as compared to a statute of limitations. That there are two related concepts there that are a little difficult for us sometimes to get to a kind of sense of the relationship between.
Certainly, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, the Oregon product liability statute has two components. Part of it is an ultimate repose. Part of it is a statute of limitation. The ultimate repose statute that we're talking about in 2909 begins to run the moment that the product at issue is purchased. So the clock starts that very first day that transaction takes place and you take your new product home. The clock is running. That's the ultimate repose. And that expires in 8 years. And that's what 2909 seeks to change. The statute of limitation begins to run when you've been injured. And we have a separate definition inside the product statute that says when you're injured, you have 2 years to bring that action. So if you buy the washing machine that I just discussed, and the defect occurs and causes injury in 6 years, you've satisfied the ultimate repose component. Now you have 2 years to file your action under the statute of limitation. So there are two distinct concepts. One doesn't begin until the injury has been suffered. The other is running from the moment that the product was purchased and will expire in 8 years. Whether the product is a product that you're going to have for 10 years, 20 years, you're out of luck at the end of the eighth year. So in the ninth year, if you're injured, the ultimate repose has already expired. You're barred. Whether you move quickly once you're injured, it has nothing to do with the limitations aspect. You're just shut out from the courthouse at the end of that eighth year. So again, in the washing machine situation, a person is injured in the seventh year. They have 2 years to bring an action pursuant to the limitations period. But if they're injured in the ninth year, it doesn't matter what the limitations period is. They are barred from proceeding. I hope that sort of distinguishes the repose and the limitations period.
Representative Krieger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you address maybe a little bit about the trends of the numbers of lawsuits? Yeah, they're growing. We got more people. We got more issues. But can you address that issue? Trends. You know, you hear about everybody suing everybody. And I'm not certain that that's exactly true. The other issue is, could you tell us a little bit about the type of awards that might be given if there was negligence or knowledge compared to unknown circumstances that caused something?
Representative Krieger, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I can respond to your question generally, but what I'd like to do is the opportunity to give you some data in Oregon, and I don't have that with me, but I'd like to make that available to you and the members of the committee. My understanding of the amount of civil actions filed in Oregon is down from years past. We have less civil actions being filed in Oregon. That data is available, and I'd like to make that available to you. As far as the amount of money, I don't think I can respond that there's, you know, X dollars being awarded, because each case needs to be evaluated on its own merits. Litigation involving a corporation that may have hid documents, as we just heard in some of the Vioxx testimony, might result in a punitive damage award that would be far greater than an ordinary negligence claim. The amount of injuries associated with a particular injury would affect the damage award. Whether it's a breadwinner who has children and there's a high amount of economic damages would affect the overall. So I don't know that I can give you that we're trending at X amount of dollars, but I think the numbers are down and the juries are very good at awarding a reasonable amount of money associated with the evidence that they hear.
Just a follow-up. Just a question. I wasn't really worrying about the dollar figure, but what were the, you know, you got punitive damages and you got actual damages for recovery as far as your health, your expenses, that type of things. Are those basically the two?
I would say that far and away the Representative Krieger, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, far and away the largest aspect, in my opinion, in civil actions is the economic component. What an individual may have lost in wages, the medical expenses, obviously, in a serious injured case, you may have lifetime care costs, which, as we all know, continue to rise. So the far and away, I think the largest component is the true economic damages. Then we have what's known as the non-economic damages, that in an injury case may be one thing, in a wrongful death case, obviously, would be another component. Punitive damages are extremely rare in this state. We have a separate statutory scheme requiring proof of clear and convincing evidence before you can even plead them in a case, and they're subject to various hurdles and procedural evidence presentation before you're even allowed to submit them to the jury.
One more little follow-up. If the person who is the victim or alleged victim of something has personal insurance, health insurance, and they pay out a large amount of money to fulfill their obligation, and then an award is given back because there was negligence somewhere, are they reimbursed? Do you know?
Chair Krieger, Representative Krieger, Chair McPherson, that's an excellent question because I think that goes to the heart of both HB 2909 and the other bill that you just heard about. Every health insurance policy, indeed almost every workers' comp policy as well, has what's called a reimbursement or subrogation clause in it, which basically says, in essence, that if your injuries are caused by the negligence of a third party, and we pay medical bills on your behalf, if you make a recovery from that third party, a manufacturer, an auto driver, you're obligated statutorily and contractually to reimburse all of the medical expenses paid by that health care provider out of that recovery. And so 2909 and the Vioxx bill, those medical bills that are being incurred by somebody, you're not permitted under existing law to go after a particular manufacturer, so therefore society at large is absorbing those health care costs, or a workers' comp carrier is absorbing those health care costs that ordinarily would be reimbursed to them.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Is it Lange?
Lange, L-A-N-E.
Lange. Thank you, Mr. Lange. I have a question about the applicability of the statute of ultimate repose in cases like the example that you provided about the Lake Oswego teachers, who I understand we'll be hearing from. Your example about the washing machine, that's perfectly clear. You buy a washing machine, and I can understand when you start running it, but this, the statute of ultimate repose from the date of the purchase. But in an instance where the person who was injured was not the purchaser, how does the statute of ultimate repose apply in that situation? Because I'm assuming the teachers didn't purchase the lights for the school did. So it's, to me, I see it as a completely different situation, and I just wonder how it applies in those cases.
Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I wish that it was different, but it's not. It doesn't matter as far as who purchased it. It's from the date of purchase is what the statute says. So I understand that teachers in Lake Oswego had nothing to do with the purchase, which I understand was approximately 1988, or the installation, or the maintenance. But when they were injured, those products had been purchased more than 8 years before their injury, and therefore they have no claim.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lane, I'm just curious, information you passed out to us that I think I saw before. Was there any discussion? This bill totally eliminates the time frame. There's a lot of states that have a time frame. Was there any discussion of just extending the time frame?
Representative Cameron, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I have not had any discussions with anybody regarding extending out. But if you choose, in the committee's wisdom, to go that way, you're basically still arbitrarily selecting a time, and you're still going to end up with egregious cases where the courthouse doors are barred, and it would be our position that no statute of ultimate repose would be far and away superior, and at least 40 other states have gone in that direction. But to answer your questions, I've not had any discussions with anybody regarding a longer period of ultimate repose.
Go ahead. Thank you. Follow-up, if I may. I notice Nebraska has a 10-year that protects products manufactured in Nebraska. Would they be doing that to help protect their own businesses in their own state? Is that to help businesses in the state of Nebraska, and if you're in another state, we don't care about you? Is that what that one means?
Representative Cameron, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I don't know for sure the legislative intent behind the ultimate repose in Nebraska, but I would have to agree that the 10-year application to products made in Nebraska would be designed to protect probably Nebraskan manufacturers. But I would note, and I think that's the beauty of the Nebraska statute, is it has the second clause there, which indicates that the statute of ultimate repose is longer if the place of manufacture is longer. So a Nebraskan injured has to figure out whether the product that caused the defect, whatever it was that caused the injury, was a Nebraskan manufacturer, and then you'd have a 10-year statute. But if it was a foreign manufacturer, a company that's manufacturing out of New Jersey, Delaware, you would, as a Nebraskan citizen, be able to look to that state where they do their home business, where they've agreed to operate from, and be subject to that ultimate repose, which in many cases may be none. So I think there's quite a bit of beauty in the Nebraskan statute, personally.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I just have one question. It seems like we're in a throwaway society, particularly in America. And you said that the civil suits are not a very high amount in Oregon. Could you give me the top three things that the products that possibly we would be discussing under this bill? What would be the impact?
Representative Kump, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, off the top of my head, I don't know if we're trending with an identifiable product that would be subject. But as we've seen in the past, with the exploding side saddle gas tanks, a product comes along that ends up barring people from pursuing their rights in court. And what we're trying to do is fix that problem, not anticipate that there's a particular product that's going to be causing injuries. I think of a lot of household goods that you buy, blenders, washing machines, automobiles. All of those, I'm at least in my experience, have a shelf life or a useful life that is in excess of 8 years. So in any of those situations, if you're injured in the ninth year, you're barred from any recovery.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lane, back to your chart, your handout you gave us. Could, as an attorney, arguing the useful life of a product, because I just went through, like a lot of my colleagues, fighting a cold or an infection the last couple of months, and it says a lot of the states have useful life of the product. The medicine I had, you know, is 1 year or something like that. I think the medication I... prescription medication that I had. So can you comment on that term, useful life? And also on the same chart, where it was ruled unconstitutional by states, was that at the local level, and has this ever gone to the federal courts?
Representative Wisnan, members of the committee, I'll try to take that in pieces backwards if I could. These are state court rulings, so the highest court in those particular states have declared those unconstitutional. Oftentimes it's a individual in a state court action. It's very rare. I won't say very rare. The constitutionality has not been presented, nor would it be presented in a federal court action. It's usually the state court, and when a case wanders up in the federal system and they're called upon to rule on, sometimes they follow a process called certification, and they send it back to the highest court of the state for a ruling on that to be applied in the federal court case. So they're state court rulings declaring it unconstitutional by the highest court of that particular state. The drug cold medicine example that you suggest, in my experience, and I think most people's experience, those particular products aren't kept around for very long. You get a cold 1 year, You go through your NyQuil or whatever your particular doctor recommends. At the end of the year, you're better, you have a great summer, and then the cold, the bug season comes back the following year, and you go ahead and you purchase that particular product at that following year. So the ultimate repose is constantly revolving, tied to the use or purchase of a particular product. It becomes problematic with the products that you buy that you're going to have for a long period of time. So I don't know the drug, the anti-inflammatories that you might have in those situations is really a good thing to look at. I think you got to look at some of the more hard, durable, long-lasting products, mechanical pieces of equipment that may be used inside of a workplace where a worker gets injured, an arm ripped off because of a lathe that was defective, a vehicle that has some sort of defect in either the airbags or the seatbelts. Those are the type of situations that more commonly arise.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lane. I guess my question is, a lot of medication does say, you know, that you get, it says it's, no, it's not good after a year or whatever. So how would that, you know, if it's printed on there and you have that, is that an out?
Representative Wizard, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, the useful life application, if the committee chose to take a look at how that works, we could provide the committee with sort of a more elaboration on those states that have adopted that. But my understanding is that that becomes a matter of proof for the litigants. So in your hypothetical, the warning, assuming it is a large warning as opposed to buried somewhere, I know sometimes you get one of those cold medicines and the inside there you pull that off before you get to the thing and there's a 40-odd page, small print, little document. A jury would have that evidence in front of it, and if they were persuaded that that useful life was, because of your example that it said only good for a year, only used for a year, whatever it said, that would be a piece of evidence to be considered. I might argue, we're talking hypotheticals here, I don't have an example, but if the advertisement in a newspaper or a magazine said, this cold medicine is the only medicine you'll ever need, good for 10 years, that would be another piece of evidence for the jury to consider. That's how I understand the useful life process works in the states that have adopted that sort of scheme.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Using the car that you were talking about, purchase of a new car, how does it affect multiple owners? One person owns it for 2 years, and so the next person buys it. That's his purchase date. Does it go by the original purchase date, or does that move forward in time?
Representative Krieger, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, it always runs from the initial purchase. So that serial number or ID number that comes in the car when you pull that open, that's going to trigger when that starts. So subsequent ownership does not matter if it's the eighth owner in a product that was sold under existing law within 8 years, they could sue. If it was an eighth owner in the ninth year, they would not be able to recover under existing law.
Mr. Lane, I have a follow-on question to one that Representative Wisner asked, which is about the those cases which have, in other states, which have held the ultimate repose statute unconstitutional. Is there any particular theory on which that's been, that ruling or holding has been established?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'll be honest, I have not read every one of the 40-odd constitutional challenges for each one of these states. Far and away, the decision is based on that particular state's constitution's remedies clause, that an individual should not be completely barred from pursuing a remedy in court.
And we've had some litigation over other attempts to restrict remedies in Oregon, which have been held unconstitutional, and it's not my area of expertise, but as I understand it, remedies that existed at the time of statehood generally can't be removed by legislation. Is sort of a kind of a very rough cut at it. So how does that interplay with the repose statute?
Chair McPherson, I'm not a constitutional scholar. I do know that the case law in Oregon is exactly that. You analyze whether there was a cause of action unrestricted at the time of statehood. So I would have to go back to the books. My hunch is that I would find a negligence action based upon a product's liability complaint, the horse and buggy that failed and existed at common law, and that's where I'd make my case. I don't know of any challenges under the remedies clause. Some of the recent cases elaborating on Oregon's remedies clause and the methodology to be applied are so new that I don't think we've had any opportunity to consider this issue under the recently announced cases on the remedies clause analysis.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then Mr. Lane, I'll excuse you.
Thank you, members of the committee.
And next on our sign-up list are Ann Kirkwood and Annette Hausinger are signed up together.
Good morning. I am Ann Kirkwood of Madras, and I am here to tell you my story and to urge you to support House Bill 2909, the bill that repeals Oregon's sour law. We all have a fundamental constitutional right to seek justice before a jury. The sour law interferes with that right and protects manufacturers of dangerous products instead of the citizens of Oregon. And I hope my story helps explain why the sour law is so unjust and why it should be repealed. One Sunday afternoon in August 1994, I was driving along Highway 97 south of Madras. Riding with me were my granddaughter, 10-year-old Erin, and Erin's half-brother, Jed, age 6. The kids had been visiting me over the weekend, and I was driving them back to their home near Redmond. Quite suddenly, an approaching vehicle veered into my lane. I had insufficient time to react to avoid the collision and broadsided the vehicle, one of the General Motors pickups with the side saddle gas tanks. Upon impact, the pickup side saddle fuel tank ruptured and gas spewed over my car. It caused a horrendous fire. Jed was pulled from the vehicle by witnesses before he was too badly injured. I was then rescued, but by the time I was extricated from my car, I had suffered severe burns. No one was able to rescue Erin, and my little granddaughter burned to death in that car. I was flown by AirLife to Emmanuel Hospital's burn unit. My attending physician told my daughter Annette that the odds were against me that I would survive, considering my age, the extent of my burns, and complications that could set in due to some badly broken limbs. Obviously, I beat the odds, and I consider myself lucky to be alive. During my first days in the hospital, my kids learned more about the pickup driven by the other driver. They learned that GM knew it was dangerous. GM knew that the side saddle gas tanks were a bad design and would explode on impact. They learned that consumer advocates had already mounted a campaign for a recall. They also learned of the extent to which the pickup manufacturer would go to prevent a recall, thus proving their fact of consideration for the welfare of the general public. Safety was apparently of little concern to General Motors. Prior to my accident, I was active with my family, my church, and my community. I was employed as a secretary, working to support myself. After my accident, it was obvious I would find even the simplest of day-to-day activities to be challenging and that returning to work would be out of the question. When we decided seeking remedy in court would be my best chance at living a comfortable life, we were devastated when we heard of the statute of ultimate repose. We were appalled that a law existed in Oregon that would forfeit the welfare of its citizens in order to protect the manufacturer of a dangerous product. Thus became the arduous task of trying to change that law, not just for my benefit, but for that of every citizen of this state. At the time of my accident, millions of these side saddle gas tank pickups were still being operated, and the lives of hundreds of more potential victims were at risk. As you know, efforts to change the law were successful, largely through the efforts of many supporters. My children, my church, and my city, Madras, came together and in one weekend raised over $25,000. We were able to hire a lobbyist. Then we were so fortunate that my elected representative stood up for me, Speaker of the House, Bev Clarno, and Senator Neil Bryant. And an exception to the statute of ultimate repose now includes vehicles with the side saddle gas tanks. But why should citizens seek exemption to a bad law? The bad law should instead be repealed. How many other citizens can be expected to gather the tremendous resources necessary to change the law? I was able to bring suit against General Motors and eventually received a settlement. I have undergone over 30 surgeries and have endured extensive, very painful therapy. I've been able to acquire a prosthetic leg, a prosthetic eye, and accessories that enable me to lead a somewhat mobile life and make my life easier. The settlement allowed me to afford those surgeries, and those surgeries probably saved my life. I am an unlucky victim of a poorly designed product, but I am fortunate in that I was able to obtain justice. Every Oregonian should expect protections by the laws of our state, and we afford the same opportunity for justice when faced with injury imposed by dangerous or defective products. And I sincerely urge you to support House Bill 2909. And I thank you for listening to my story.
Ms. Kirkwood, thank you very much for coming all this way to tell about your personal experience, and it certainly is a demonstration that the decisions that we make in this building have a real impact on the lives of Oregonians. Why don't we go and hear from Ms. Hausinger before we
thank
open
you.
For questions.
Good morning. I am Annette Hausinger of Madras, the daughter of Ann Kirkwood. I am here to urge your support of House Bill 2909 and to repeal the Sauer Law. The law is a danger to society, and my mother's story shows why. I'm sure you can appreciate what our family has gone through after hearing from Mom about her accident. The loss of Aaron is without a doubt the toughest part to bear. She was my brother Joe's daughter. She was a very sweet girl, and she was the only grandchild in our family. It is a horrible event to watch her grandchild die such a painful and unnecessary death, or to watch her mother suffer. Mom spent 2 months in Emanuel Hospital's burn unit and another 3 months in a skilled nursing facility before she was able to return home. Her recovery is ongoing and has been slow and often terribly painful for her. She continues to suffer from the loss of a limb, an eye, and the debilitating effects of thick burn tissue and deformed facial features and hands. Mom will, unfortunately, live with these injuries the rest of her life. My brother and I learned about the pickup involved in Mom's accident during her first few days in the burn unit. We were informed the pickup had an infamous side saddle gas tank and recalled the notoriety the vehicle received in the news. We wasted little time in obtaining legal counsel for Mom, confident we were taking the appropriate steps to protect her future. The more we learned about the side saddle gas tank pickups, the more frustrated we became. We read about testimony from experts, even those employed by the manufacturer, proclaiming the flaws in the fuel tank design of the trucks and the threat they pose to people when involved in accidents. We learned about the lengths to which the manufacturer would go to dispute those claims. We heard about efforts by concerned citizens to force a recall of the pickups and the support those folks received from the Secretary of Transportation. We were faced with a reality that, had it not been for the rupturing of the pickup's fuel tank and the fire that resulted, Mom would have suffered only a few broken bones and my niece would not have burned to death. The manufacturer did not cause the accident, but they were sure as heck responsible for the severity of it and the devastating outcome. We were determined that they be held accountable. Then, as if all this reality wasn't enough to handle, we were informed by Mom's attorney of the statute of ultimate repose. This law, much to our dismay, appeared to have been designed not to protect the citizens of our state, but to protect the manufacturers of products that may cause harm to the citizens of this state. We had to face the fact that in order to even be able to file a suit against the manufacturer, we had to seek an exception to that law. We had to jump hurdles imposed by our own state in order to seek justice for our mother. Well, we went through the proper channels and started the painstaking steps to secure that exception. It was not an exception easily gained, for the manufacturer sent an army of lobbyists determined to prevent us from being successful. It was a battle. We fought hard and were ultimately successful in our quest to have the law changed. Mom was finally able to file a suit against the manufacturer and rightfully received compensation for her injuries and loss of independence. Oregonians should not have to seek an exception in order to obtain justice. We all have a constitutional right to seek justice before a jury. The Sauer Law takes away that right. It should be repealed. I urge you to support House Bill 2909 and repeal the statute of ultimate repose. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hasen. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but I just want to thank you both for coming all this way. And I know it's hard to, you probably relive everything by telling the story, but I just want you to know how much we appreciate your doing that and sharing that with us, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate you listening. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'll echo that on behalf of the entire committee. We do appreciate your coming this all this way and telling your about your family's tragedy.
Thank you.
Next, we have a panel of teachers. I may murder some of these names here. Joel LaFollette, Mary Nierhatborg, Denise Leher, and Sherry Rhodes. And if you could realize there are only three seats there ordinarily, but if you could kind of crowd around the microphones, that would be helpful. And pull up an extra chair if need be.
Good morning. My name is Joel LaFollette from Westland, Oregon, and my wife is one of the teachers that was involved in this accident. So I'd like to lead off by providing you with a little information about the accident. I'll be brief. On November 12, 2004, approximately 70 teachers were injured in a Lake Oswego school gymnasium when they were exposed to ultraviolet radiation from a broken metal halide light, a type R metal halide light, a light that was not equipped with a self-extinguishing feature. Even though the protective lens on the bulb was broken, the light continued to burn. Over a 5.5-hour period, the teachers directly under that light received 41 days worth of ultraviolet radiation. Every 8 minutes, they exceeded a 24-hour dose. In the hours that followed their exposure, these teachers ended up in area emergency rooms. Some were thinking they were going blind. Others suffered temporary loss of vision, severe burning pain in their eyes and exposed skin. No one knew exactly what had happened. Six teachers today, 27 months after the accident, are still suffering the effects of their exposure. Their lives and the lives of their families have been dramatically changed. They cannot participate in outdoor activities, and as you can see, in most cases, room lights need to be dimmed for them to be comfortable. They suffer constant pain and have ongoing medical procedures that they still look forward to. My wife, Kelly, is home today because she's on a six-month medical leave required by our doctor. Her eyes have not even changed slightly since the exposure 27 months ago. She suffers from severe photophobia, which is sensitivity to light, and what is commonly referred to as severe dry eye. Basically, the surface of her eye looks like wadded-up cellophane. It's constantly sloughing off and causing pain. This condition brings on migraines, and being home, she spends most of her time in the darkest portions of our home. We purchased our home 6 years ago because of the light, 18-foot north light windows and skylights in every room, and there's only two rooms that she can be comfortable in on a bright sunny day like today. We've been resorting to brown paper on the windows here recently. This past week, she visited the doctor for her monthly checkup, and she received some news that unless we see dramatic improvement in the next 2 months, she's looking at a much longer time at home. How long, nobody can say. The accident at Lake Oswego is not an isolated accident. This has happened many times. I've documented it. It's happened in Tennessee. It's happened in Oregon before. Even after the accident in Lake Oswego, it has happened in Tennessee again and in South Dakota. These lights are a danger, and we have been working to remove these lights from the public areas that they're used. A little over 2 weeks ago, I was in the state capitol here testifying for Senate Bill 479, which would remove these lights from schools in the state of Oregon, removing the danger that harmed my wife, and hopefully protect others. The members of that committee unanimously passed on to the Senate with a full recommendation that particular bill. They recognized the danger that these lights posed. When my wife and her colleagues were injured, it was not so obvious what had happened at the time. The cause and extent was unknown, and another unknown was that an Oregon law would prohibit us from seeking restitution from the manufacturer of the light. Oregon's Sauer Law requires that we prove that the light in question was placed into service within the last 8 years of the time of the accident. Common sense tells us that the likelihood that that light burning for 8 years is not, it's not probable. Research into the issue shows that the date on the bulb in question was 1988. Now, that's the manufacturer's date code. That is the only date that we can so far tie to that particular light bulb. Common sense tells us that the bulb was probably installed within 2 years of the accident. Most school districts that I've contacted say that they have a regular maintenance schedule where they'll go in every 2 years for this particular gym and 2 years later the next gym or whatever. They have a rotating schedule because it takes a scissor lift to get up and remove these lights. They're 19 to 20 feet off the ground. The Sauer Law would require that we get the records from the manufacturer, the distributor, and maintenance records from the school dating back to 1996 all in an attempt to find the purchase date of one light bulb. Our legal efforts, I'm speaking for my wife and I, are not to receive compensation, but they're to remove this dangerous product from use in Oregon. If we can get that to happen, we can address other states and eventually the nation. These lights are not needed. There are safer alternatives. There are more energy efficient alternatives. These lights are cheap to manufacture. The technology is from the 40s. They're no longer needed in our society. Everything we do, we accept some reasonable risks. In my profession, when I launch my drift boat on the Deschutes, I accept the fact of rapids, rattlesnakes, a bad back cast from a novice fly angler. But I learned to deal with those. I learned to duck. I learned to row my boat. I learned to be very careful where I put my hands and feet when walking on the trail. You shouldn't have unreasonable risks in a school gymnasium. When you're there to expand your education, to help others expand theirs. I urge you to protect the citizens of Oregon and support House Bill 2909. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Follett. And I'll let the other members of the panel, Ms. Borg, Ms. Flutter, Ms. Rhodes, do go in whatever order you decide.
Okay. My name is Mary Nierhout Borg. I'll go next. And being a teacher, I know some of you are oral listeners and some are visual. So this is an example of the eye drops that each of us use each month. And without these, I couldn't get through the day. None of us could. That's a one-month supply that SAFE will provide for me. Often I go buy more on my own money because that's not enough. So these are the sunglasses. I never owned a pair of sunglasses in my life before this happened. I have ones for reading computer screens, one for reading books. I have ones that block the side. I have ones for driving at night that cut the glare. I have ones that go over these for when it's too bright. So I now have become a sunglasses addict. Some of you might forget your sunglasses when you go out. It's a sunny day and you go out and you think, oh, I forgot my sunglasses. I go out at 6 to head to work and it's pitch dark and I have on my sunglasses. And if I forget them, of course it's pitch black outside, who would remember them? By the time I get to the end of my driveway, I actually have an anxiety attack because I almost pulled out into a street without my sunglasses on, and the overhead lamps, the cars coming at me, causes searing pain. So it's when we say extreme photophobia, think of that next time you open your refrigerator and that little light goes on. If you jump back a foot and a half, then you probably know what our life is like. I'm assuming that you've gotten my testimony, so I'm going to try not to read it because there's so many of us. I'll just hit a few points. Joel mentioned the photophobia. I've just touched on that. Extreme dry eye is like cellophane. When people look at our eyes, you can't see it, but if you drew a picture of our eye, it is full of holes. The doctor's drawings of our eyes are an eye with just dots. It's as though each of our eyes had sand thrown in it, and each grain of sand burned down through our eye, down to the basal DNA level. So most of you grow a new eye cover every few weeks. We grow faulty ones. Some months we might grow a better one. Some months we grow one that's not so good. But we have corneal abrasions because our eyes are so swollen they don't fit in the sockets. So every time I blink, it's like rubbing sandpaper across my eye. In the morning, I often wake up and my eyes are sealed shut. It takes a good 15 to 20 minutes to even just open my eyes normally. And that's after maybe a steaming shower and a slew of those. We have all had our tear ducts surgically plugged, which is basically having, with your eye wide open, a doctor insert a needle in your eye. You have to sit there with it wide open. he wounds it out, and then he shoves a manhole cover as far as he can down your eye. The reason our tear ducts are plugged is they're doing anything they can to keep any amount of moisture on our eye, and it still doesn't work. I would like, you'd think I'd be able to go and seek a panel of my peers and ask them to hold the manufacturer accountable for this, selling a product that it knows is dangerous and whose dangers were hidden to people like me. But Oregon law currently chooses to protect its manufacturers or other manufacturers over its consumers and citizens. We're not here today asking you to decide to give us a judgment. Our purpose is just to ask, can we have our day in court? That's what we're asking you for. Current law makes Oregonians a very vulnerable minority of people who have no recourse, and Phillips is very aware of this. Phillips has refused to aid us in any way. No compensation for medical bills, no medical information from other injuries they've collected around the country. They are aware of this problem. They have other reports of injuries, but they will not share information with us. And I'm sorry, I think it was Representative Krieger was talking about amounts of money awarded or something like that. And I have to say that until you've received the basic ha-ha letter from a manufacturer saying too bad you don't live 12 miles north in Washington or any of 39 other states you could have done something, but because you live in Oregon, we don't have to give you any information. It's a very disheartening letter to receive, and they know that we live in Oregon and they don't have to help us. Also, Phillips continues to sell and manufacture these dangerous lights with impunity because the most documented injuries caused by them, us, live in a state that allows them to get away with it. Why should Oregon deprive its citizens of justice when 40 other states don't? I know I'm supposed to speak more on a personal level, so now I'll go to a totally personal level on how this has affected me. The inability to seek any compensation has left me in quite a bind. I, myself, and Denise here are temporary teachers. We don't have permanent status at Lake Oswego School District. In fact, we were both just 2 months into the job when this happened. This means that every year, yesterday as a matter of fact, we got our termination letters. Thank you for your services. We think you're wonderful. You no longer have a job. Because I don't have permanent status, we're both forced to work while suffering from constant pain and discomfort in order to look good for our bosses so we get hired next year. It's a daily concern that if I take sick days to go to the doctor or dim lights too much or say I can't keep up with grading my papers, that this will be a disruption to the class and be a bad mark on my record. Who's going to hire me? Due to my inability to seek financial recourse, I don't really have the luxury of acknowledging my pain at work or asking them to help by providing me with extra help for grading or so forth. I haven't read a book for pleasure in over 2 years. Imagine a teacher that doesn't read. By the end of the day, I have a headache. I have a migraine. It's all I can do to grade my papers. Who's going to hire a teacher that doesn't read? I work in darkened rooms. I grin and bear it so the students don't have to put up with living in the dark. I live in constant fear that I'll be unable to do my job well enough to get hired and thus lose my source of income and livelihood and insurance for my family. There's also the constant fear that the damage will progress. They have no idea what this is going to mean. One of the victims has already come down with facial cancer. Corneas are a big possibility. I personally fear I might go blind from this because I ask every day by toughing it out at work so I keep my job, am I further damaging myself? I urge you to repeal this law that allows manufacturers to create and market dangerous products with impunity in Oregon. You've talked about the useful life of a product. I'm talking about the useful life of citizens. To me, I know which one I choose among those two. Also, you ask why not extend the sour law from 8 years to 10 or 12, because unfortunately the victims are the ones that have to go to bat for themselves, and they're the ones right now that emotionally are dealing with families that are having to go through this. They can't help us. You're relying on the victim themselves to come up with the money, the chutzpah and the time to go to battle for themselves. And frankly, it is an overwhelming task. Overwhelming. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Borg. And either Ms. Rhodes or Ms. Fletcher.
My name is Denise Fletcher. I'm also one of the teachers in Lake Oswego. I teach fifth and sixth grade. And a lot of what Mary said is my same exact situation. I'm one of the temporary employees, and I feel the same way she does. And so I am also here to say how dangerous the Sauer Law is to Oregon citizens and strongly urge you to support the House Bill 2909 to repeal this very outdated law. It was over 2 years ago that I experienced how dangerous this halide type R light can be and how helpless the Sauer Law makes us because it protects the manufacturers of dangerous products and leaves Oregon citizens vulnerable and helpless. I truly believe that it's time to change the law and give the citizens recourse. Philips Lighting, the manufacturer, they know that the product is dangerous. As Mary said, they also know that we live in Oregon and there's nothing we can do about it. They've received numerous complaints. The government knows that the halide lights are dangerous, and that's why there's an FDA warning, but it's on the outside packaging. We never saw the packaging. The day that our incident occurred, we started complaining to the administration and to the custodial staff. Apparently, none of them knew of the dangers either. Nobody knew it was lights that were harming us. Honestly, at first I thought I was getting sick when I started feeling warm and then started feeling pain and my eyes were watering. I think a lot of other people felt the same way. Then we thought maybe there was a chemical in the air. Nobody knew it was the lights. Philips knew. A package warning is not enough. And right now I feel like we have nothing that we can do about this to help other people. When I left the in-service that day, I was hoping that my eyes would get better after I left the room, and instead they just continued to get worse because like a sunburn, it continued to burn. The in-service started at 8 in the morning, and I probably did not hit my worst pain until midnight that night. I was in a car accident because of it, because I did not realize how my vision would be affected with lights. And when I drove later that night, all of the lights from the cars in front of me, the taillights, ran together. I did not realize this until I got on the freeway, and I hit somebody because of it. I was devastated when that happened. I've never even gotten a speeding ticket, and I hit somebody, and there was a child in that car. My husband took me to the hospital that night, and even the doctors had no idea what could be causing this to my eyes. They insisted that I had pink eye, an infection, because my eyes were completely red. I knew I did not have an infection. I knew my eyes were not itching, but I was in extreme pain. And when I left that night, they still, what they prescribed for me was the medication for pink eye, an infection. That weekend, we were told when they first discovered it was the lights that it would, the pain, the symptoms would only last for 24 hours. Then we were told 48 hours, then 2 weeks, then 2 months, and here we are more than 2 years. They don't know what will happen to us. My life has been severely affected by all of this. Mary has explained the pain that we feel, the sandpaper. It feels like we have sandpaper in our eyes, the constant pain all day, every day. I don't want to stop teaching. I'm dedicated to my job, and I feel like what I do is extremely important and that I make a difference. But I give everything I can to my children at school, and then I have three more at home that I feel like suffer because I cannot give to them anymore when I get home. I can't read books to them at night anymore because I've already done all I can do during the day. And I now have to pass off that pleasure to my husband or my oldest daughter who will read to the younger ones. And I miss that. I miss going fishing with them. My husband takes them now and I can't go. Or when we go camping, I can't sit by the campfire with them because the heat and the dryness, will hurt my eyes and I will pay the price for it later. If I try to do anything that I used to do with them in the outdoors, I have to pay for it later. Even air conditioning, any flow of air hurts my eyes. Air conditioning, when we turn the heats on in the wintertime, it hurts my eyes. So you can see there's so many things I never thought of before, but now I pay the price for those things. And I don't know how long it will last. And it seems there's nothing we can do about it. We don't know. We can't get better, it seems. And we have no justice that we can turn to, and a difficult time in trying to help other people. At the beginning of the journey, we tried to educate people on the hazards of the lights, but I fear that's not enough. Even if someone who works around the lights now knows of the dangers, the next person who takes their place probably won't. It is a little-known issue that can cause great harm. We can only prevent this from happening to children by removing Type R halide lights, and we need the Sauer Law repeal to do that. I urge you to give the citizens the power to hold manufacturers of dangerous products accountable. Almost every other state in the country would allow us our constitutional right to seek justice, but Oregon is one of the few that doesn't, and that needs to change. I urge your support of House Bill 2909. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fletcher. Ms. Rhodes?
Yeah, my name is Cheryl Rhodes, and I live in West Lynn. I was the physical education teacher in the gym at Bryant. I was not there on the day that it was broken. It was broken 3 weeks prior to the in-service where these people were injured and the other 70. I did not have any idea when I came back to work. The light was still burning. The kids had said, oh, the volleyball hit the light. Oh, it's still burning. Oh, I guess everything's all right. I worked in that gym for 3 weeks, 2.5 days a week. So I have over 32 hours of exposure to those lights. And with the 8 minutes, you know, a day's every 8 minutes, I have no idea exactly how many hours I was exposed at that point. We've talked about the pain. It's there all of the time. When I go to work, I work in the gym, and I work in a visor and sunglasses. On days that my eyes really hurt, it's very hard to be at work. I always scan wherever I go, watching the children to make sure. And every time you look up, the bulb, even though the lights have been changed, the brightness of the bulbs that are in there now send searing pain into your eyes. So it's painful to be at work. The headaches are always there. We've talked about the reading, the going outside. Every time I go home, the first thing my husband asks is, how are your eyes today, before he asks if we can go anywhere or do anything. I live like this in my home, you know, day and night. It's very hard for me to, you know, go out. If it's a bright day, there'll be days that it'll be too bright and my husband is driving, and I will put a blindfold on and lay down, lay the seat back so I don't have the light coming into my eyes. Some days are better than others, yeah, but there are those days that you have to just go home, put a blindfold on, and lay down in bed because that's all you can do. And that totally has changed not only my life, but the life of my family, as everyone else here. As far as the lights, Philips does make a light bulb and has made a light bulb that self-extinguishes in 15 minutes. This did not need to happen. Philips still sells the light bulbs that will burn people, even though they have a product that is safe. They have chosen to keep selling it because it is cheaper. And there's nothing, you know, there's no recourse that we have to go, since we have the law that we can't do anything, and they know they can't, that we can't do anything to them. When they talk about the useful life of a product and the bulb, when it was purchased, well, the useful life of a bulb is you purchase, how many light bulbs do you buy and then you put in right then? You buy them and you keep them and you put them in when they need to be changed. You know, 8 years, you know, if you buy them in bulk, is which the district probably does, and I don't remember when I bought a light bulb, exactly what day I purchased it, so it's the time the bulb is put in and the light turned on, how long is it going to last? Well, that's the part that we don't know. I had planned to be teaching for at least another 10 years. I am going to take early retirement because I cannot do this. It's just too hard every day to go home and have the headaches and lay down, go to work, go home, and that's it. You know, some days are better, but a lot of days that's all I do. And so this is going to have a huge financial impact on my family. It'll limit the amount of financial assistance I can provide for our son, who is in his first year of law school. He'll now have to incur much more debt than we had planned for his education and start his adult life deep in debt. It breaks my heart. I'm not able to provide for him what I had promised. And afterwards, I have no idea whether we'll be able to keep the house that we have right now. After my income is going to be greatly, reduced. But I know that I cannot keep doing this. It's just too hard. We do need to start protecting the citizens of Oregon from defective products and stop protecting big businesses by letting them claim that a dangerous product is not their problem if it's over 8 years old. I'm living proof that a product manufactured over 8 years old can still pose a real danger to the public it you serve and change their lives forever. Please repeal the sour law and give the citizens of Oregon a chance to have their day in court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rhodes. Are there any questions for any member of this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many children are affected by that? Do we know, or was there any, or there period where not long enough in there? Or?
Part of the time that I was in the gym, when you're in the gym and the children are constantly moving, okay, the moving through in and out, okay, they get very little. It's where they were seated in one certain place, or on the days that I chose to, that I was refereeing volleyball, and that's where I had set the net up, or we were doing a tinkling pole activity, and they were set up in a certain place, and so I was stationed there that whole day.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I was just going to say, if you think of the radiation that got to us like a pebble in water going out, if you're in the bad bandwidth, then you got it worse than maybe others who went to the hospital but were better after 3 days or better after a week or better after. We were in the worst bandwidth, and that's why we are significantly worse than maybe others who went to the hospital but seemingly recovered.
There were no children present during that in-service. It was a teacher's in-service training day.
But for the 3 weeks prior, children had been complaining of eye irritation, had been sent home sick. They swiped down the gym thinking it must be chemical. They had a crew come in and clean it. There was just no one even guessed it was a light bulb.
Thank you. Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really sad story, and it should be prevented. I hope the Department of Education has issued across the state to gyms and to school districts this danger. Has that happened?
Yes. The problem is that, as you know, our school districts are definitely underfunded, and they have started the process of removing the lights. In fact, the Senate bill that I referred to, most of the school districts have already started to remove the lights. Lake Oswego did, and they went to high-efficiency fluorescent tubes versus a metal halide-type self-extinguishing bulb. They changed all the fixtures. Most schools, as the word got out, because we have developed a lot of press from this particular incident, there is more awareness, and they are keeping an eye on the lights that are currently installed, and they are, as they can afford to, removing them. The Senate bill is basically putting a deadline to maybe put a little exclamation point on the need to do so.
But these lights aren't only in gyms. They're in barns. They're in Costco's probably. I mean, they're everywhere.
If there are no further questions, then I would like to thank you for coming. And this terrible incident happened within my district, and it was a deeply disturbing thing to the community generally to have something happen in a local school where in a district which is otherwise, I think, rightly proud of their schools. So we feel compassion for the injuries that you and your loved ones have suffered.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Bill Gaylord.
Good
Mr. Gaylord.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Gaylord. I'm a lawyer in Portland. That's not what's important, and I'm not going to do a lawyerly job of lecturing you about the law, I hope. My intent here really is to kind of channel a young man whose story I think you need to know in your consideration of this case. I've handed up some written material with my comments, probably more extensive than I'm going to give them now, and some attachments, which I'll spend a moment explaining. I need to confess that I mislabeled the bill that we're here to talk about because of my misinformation late last night when I was doing this about 12 hours ago. So it says HB 444, which I think is this. It should be Senate Bill 444, which I believe is identical to House Bill 2909, which is really what I'm here to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about the Stephen Sharp story. I am a lawyer whose three-person law firm probably spends half our time doing products liability work, which is one of my reasons for interest in this bill and this story. I'm a poor substitute for young Mr. Sharp, and he would have been here if he could. He's moved to Fresno, and this week, when we found out the time for the hearing, we just couldn't match it up with conflicts in his arrangements for his new housing down there. And we didn't have the way to bring him by satellite to you. So let me just give you a bit of his story, if I may. Stephen Sharp was a 17-year-old high school student at Richland, Oregon, over just outside of Hell's Canyon in Baker County in 1992. And that August, he was working summer work, running a hay baler on somebody else's farm. He was operating a 1972 Case International tractor. The baler had a tendency to jam and have to go back and be manually cleared of the clog. He did as instructed, which was to put the power takeoff unit in the tractor in neutral. The PTO on that tractor was defectively designed. It was defective from the get-go. It was defective even in 1972. And manufacturers of those machines knew how to make one that would not have a false neutral and would not pop into gear and self-start, but not this one. And it did self-start. He was back there with his hands in the baler pulling the hay out when the PTO popped into gear. One of his hands was caught immediately. He reached in with his other one to pull that one out, and they were both caught. It was a fight for his life. He braced his head against the top of the opening into the baler. He wrapped his legs around the tongue of the trailer of the baler, and he fought for 30 to 40 minutes until his arms were both removed above the elbow, one just below the shoulder, one just above the elbow. He had the presence of mind to cauterize the stumps of his arms on the spinning machinery. He thought, of course, he needed to get help. His first effort was to try to climb up on the tractor and drive it back, and, of course, not realizing at first it hadn't registered that he had no way to climb on the tractor, so he fell flat on his face. It took him probably 10 minutes to get up off the ground. He found a way, losing a lot of blood, to stagger along a wire line that he knew would lead him a half a mile to the nearest farmhouse. He entered the farmhouse, kicking the screen door open, and the man who was there collapsed when he saw it. Stephen collapsed too. The man fortunately woke up, and they got him help. And that began the saga of months and months of surgeries and rehabilitation and recovery and his life as a substantially altered human being. Stephen, of course, ran right smack into the Oregon statute of ultimate repose. Learned, as hardly anybody ever learns before they need it, that in Oregon there is no remedy for a product that is more than 8 years old that is as dangerous and defective as that. It's of note to my mind that this tractor was 20 years old and was a piece of farm equipment. Now, let me make clear, I'm not Stephen's lawyer. I have not had the privilege of representing him. I simply, I heard his story on NPR a few days after it happened, and I've never forgotten that. When his story became of some national note because of the what ensued afterwards in his legal quests, I was interested. I knew the lawyer from Minnesota who became involved with his case, and I just happened to be fortunate enough to become acquainted with Stephen. So I'm telling you his story just as a friend of his, I guess I could say. I learned from people in the agricultural industry that farm equipment, of all things, has to have a long, useful life, has to be able to be kept in service, because farmers couldn't stay in business if they couldn't do the maintenance and keep the repair work up and keep a tractor running for 20 years. It's not at all unusual for a tractor to be twice that old and still be used. Stephen couldn't bring a claim in Oregon because of the 1977 law that imposed this 8-year time limit and protected essentially foreign manufacturers, because we aren't really the kind of state that has much of that industry. Fortunately, it's hard to think of Stephen as lucky unless you pay close attention to the kind of spirit that he was born with and the kind of man that he is, but he was lucky in this respect. A friend of his father had seen a couple of years earlier a classified ad in an agricultural equipment magazine from a lawyer who had a case involving this problem with this tractor and a man that had been pulled into the baler and killed. That was an ad placed by a lawyer trying to find out if there were other stories around the country. That lawyer was Bill Manning from Minnesota. The friend of Stephen Sharp's father passed the magazine, found the magazine, 2 years old, passed the ad on to Stephen's family, and they connected with Bill Manning, and he was able to bring the case for Stephen Sharp in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is the home of the Gase International company. They had their trial in Racine, Wisconsin, right down the street from the J.J. Case High School. Imagine the kind of hurdles they had in order to win that lawsuit, but they did. They won the lawsuit. They won a substantial verdict for Stephen. The story of Stephen Sharp is much better told than I can do in this book. And Exhibit A to my materials is actually the front cover of this, slightly enlarged. I recommend this just for its reading. It's quite a compelling story, very well written. I have an extra copy if anybody wants to borrow it. I give it to you if that's not against the law, but you're welcome to read it. Either way, if anybody's that interested, please, it's quite a story. The moral of the story is the person in Oregon who's seriously injured by a defective product shouldn't have to go elsewhere to seek a remedy. A moral of the story for me is what is Oregon doing protecting a manufacturer of this product when its own state, where it comes from, doesn't find that necessary? The other thing I attach to my materials is I don't suppose you're all going to slog through it, but it is a full copy of the opinion published in June of 1999 of the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the case of Stephen Joel Sharp versus Case Corporation. What's of interest in that case, there's a lot of material in there, and in fact it spends quite a bit of time talking about a case of mine called Lakin versus Sinco that was in the Oregon Supreme Court. But what's of interest here, I highlighted on page 4 and 5 of the opinion, it simply says, this will be very quick, quote, the first issue presented by Case Corporation is whether the Court of Appeals erred in refusing to apply the Oregon statute of repose applicable to products liability actions, which Case Corporation asserts would bar the action as untimely. There's some chutzpah. Case Corporation is going to the Wisconsin courts claiming that the Oregon law should protect them in Wisconsin from responsibility for selling a dangerously defective product. I also highlighted this. Case Corporation contends that because the tractor in issue was first sold in 1972, any liability on its part for Sharp's 1992 injuries was precluded by the 8-year limitation in the Oregon statute of repose. And on the next page, here's where they resolve that part of it. So there's a lot of other issues. But that legal issue was resolved this way. Quote, because Wisconsin law contains no such statute of repose, we hold that no genuine conflict exists between the laws of Wisconsin and Oregon on this issue, and we conclude that Sharp's action is timely under Wisconsin law. So that's why it's a good news story, ultimately, for Stephen Sharp. He was able to get the compensation he needed. He's able to live a life now with no arms. I'm told he's in a business now. He's planning to start a business in Fresno of rehabbing houses that have been reclaimed by the government there. Of course, he's not going to do the work, but he's going to general contract it. The Oregon statute of ultimate repose is far shorter than the useful life of farm equipment and many other examples. I'll tell you from personal experience, I represented a group of firefighters who were killed in the rollover of 15-passenger Ford van over in Colorado a few years ago. That particular van was only a year or so old. We did not have the problem of the Oregon statute of ultimate repose, but the design that that van was defective because of dated to 1978. There are still many defective 15-passenger vans on the highways of Oregon, most of whose victims will not be able to bring a claim in Oregon. The number of examples are numerous, and when we couldn't begin to list them all. There were questions about what kinds of products would this apply to. Well, particularly equipment, moving equipment, vehicle equipment, those are the kinds of things that typically last long enough and that typically create great risk when they are defective. We've had a number of piecemeal exceptions to the statute of ultimate repose in Oregon. You heard from Ms. Kirkwood and the exception that the legislature adopted for the side saddle tank pickup trucks. I think we have generally recognized that there are problems with our statute of ultimate repose. We've made several exceptions. Asbestos is an exception now. Dalcon Shield IUD was the first exception, I believe. And the question really is, does it make sense to keep cutting holes in a bad law? Or should we simply recognize what's wrong with it and adopt a better starting point than that? Those are my comments. I'm happy to to answer any questions. There was a question Mr. Chair asked earlier that I think I might have known the answer to, but I'm not sure that you're concerned about that. In fact, I will address it if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The question about products liability law and had that been tested constitutionally for the statute of ultimate repose in Oregon, or actually for the question of the original common law state of things in Oregon. The Lakin versus Sinco case, which was the nail gun, I represented that gentleman, and that opinion of the Oregon Supreme Court does find that products liability existed at common law at the constitutional time of Oregon, so that it is subject to constitutional rights associated with our state constitution. However, the challenges that were brought in the early years of ultimate repose law in Oregon were not successful on constitutional grounds. There are no challenges pending. I don't think you can assume that a constitutional challenge will change the playing field here or help any of these victims in products liability.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gaylord. We are on the floor at 10:30, so committee, if there are particular questions you think it would be useful to present, please ask them, but we have a limited amount of time to cover several other witnesses here, and these bills will not move today. These are complex issues, so we need to gather more input over time. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope it's a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Gaylord. You practice primarily in products liability law, and with the example of Stephen Sharp's finding an attorney who filed suit in the place of manufacturer for that particular farm equipment, is that a mechanism that other injured parties would have to file in the state wherever they're offending whatever it is was manufactured?
Thank you. Representative Flores, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Had I read my notes more directly, I would have actually tried to answer that question, and I didn't. I'll have to admit, as a lawyer, I was impressed and surprised to discover that in Stephen Sharp's case, he made that connection and they were successful going to another state for that outcome. I know that fingers were crossed very sharply during the time that the Wisconsin appellate courts were considering that question, because it is not routine or at all clear that what they call the choice of laws question that the Wisconsin Supreme Court dealt with will come down in favor of the place of the accident as opposed to the place where the action is being brought for this analysis. I do not know of another successful example of somebody who was injured in Oregon and barred by the statute of ultimate repose and successfully went somewhere else to bring their case. It's something we think of more often now because we know about Stephen Sharp's case. It may become something that is more useful in the future, but I don't believe anybody thinks that's the route that's going to solve this problem. It's very iffy whether you're going to get a favorable ruling in that foreign state. And besides, of course, it's even if it's a solution, it's an awful long ways to make an Oregon person go.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, and thank you, Mr. Gaylord.
Thank you.
Next, Lisa Trussell and Paul Hurd.
Does anybody want to?
There he goes, breaking the rules.
I'm sure it's on loan. On loan.
Final record.
Get a library card.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Trussell, and I represent the members of Associated Oregon Industries. And we appreciate the opportunity to comment this morning on House Bill 2909. We have some concerns with the bill, and although I appreciate the stories that were heard today, it's those were very difficult circumstances. The one thing about the Oregon statute that it gives, particularly manufacturers, is some sort of predictability in potential liability claims, and whether 8 years is the right number or the wrong number, it is a number that provides some sort of a time of finality on claims. The longer it goes from the time of the sale or the manufacture till the claim's filed, evidence gets old or disappears. People change and they're not available anymore. And it's just people's memories change. We think that, and products do have a natural life, and I would probably agree that a tractor lasts longer than a washing machine. It seems like every 5 years I'm getting a new washing machine. And I've never bought a tractor, so I really don't know how long they last. But anyway, we would, we are supportive of the, of a time, a finite amount of time to file these claims. And we think that, like the workers' comp system in Oregon, the statute of repose is an advantage for Oregon businesses. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hurd.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Hurd, General Counsel at Freightliner. I'll be very, very brief because I know our time is short. Just to second what Lisa said, I think for manufacturers, we see the repose statute as being a logical cutoff from perpetual liability, if you will, for manufactured products that in the ordinary course of their life are going to suffer from wear and tear. Eventually, they may break, something may happen as a result of long-term usage. Just to give you an example of something that occurred with our one of our affiliate companies, they were sued recently in Louisiana because for a streetcar they made back in the early part of the 20th century. This streetcar had been in use for, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 years. They don't even make streetcars anymore. But there was no repose statute there, and they were subject to a lawsuit over that. And so I think manufacturers see the need, and we see the need for having some cutoff, and that was the reason for the repose statute being enacted to begin with. For very, very old products that may be 30, 40, 50 years old, it's extremely difficult to try to defend cases where documents are gone, the people who were around when the product was made are gone. It becomes extremely difficult for the manufacturer to deal with those situations. Another related issue for us is just the cost of insurance that goes with that when you basically have, again, perpetual liability for products that may have been manufactured a long time ago, may have been misused, and may have had many, many people trying to maintain these products, and it's often very difficult for juries to separate out the issues of the maintenance and wear and tear and misuse issues from allegations that the product was defective, particularly the older the product is. So, and I also would tell you that I think manufacturers, when they look at states to locate in, one of the things they look at is there laws that deal with these situations. Toyota, for example, recently located a major facility in Mississippi, and one of the reasons was because Mississippi had done significant reform, tort reform. So I just point that out, that manufacturers do look at these issues like this when they choose to locate plants in a particular state. So that's basically summarizes what I had in mind here today. And if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to try to address them.
Just if I may, real briefly, what would Freightliner do if, for example, you discovered a part or something was defective on a truck that was 15 years old? Would you try to do a recall or a notification? And I realize that something, a truck that old, it may have again passed on to different owners.
Yes. Representative Barker, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Yes, we would. We have a continuing duty under the National Highway Traffic Safety Act to respond to safety issues related to products, and we would either recall the product if it was required, put out a service bulletin, or we'd take steps to make sure that we had dealt with whatever defective, no matter how old the product was. Could be a product that was 50 years old. We would still respond to it.
Representative Wisnick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gaylord, your comment that you made about...
I'm Mr. Herdman.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
The chair gave me. I thought you were asking who the problem.
I thought you wanted to compare. You wanted to draw on information that we presented us earlier. This is Mr. Hurd.
We're okay. You made the comment about that Freightliner put a move to one of your subsidies, or part of Freightliner moved to Mississippi because of tort reform. That was one of the factors.
Yes, sir. Yes, Representative Quisnick, Chairman McPherson, that was one of the things that caused Toyota. Toyota is not related to us, but Toyota did locate in Mississippi for as a result directly of what has been done in Mississippi with respect to tort reform.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So to follow up with that, of the 40 states that do not have a limit on the suit, how many of those have tort reform, have a limitation on the liability?
Representative, wasn't it Chair McPherson, members of the committee? I haven't. I have not done a study of that. I can't really answer your question intelligently. I'm sorry.
Might be interesting to have.
We're running short on time here, so what I'd like to do, if there unless there are burning questions here right now, would be to excuse this panel
and
then what I'd because we're going to have to clear out here to the floor in 10 minutes. The only other witness signed up on this bill is Jim Gardner. And Mr. Gardner, if it's all right with you, what I'd like to do is to close this public hearing and go back to resume the hearing on 2448. And if we don't get a chance to hear you on either of these bills, then the understanding would be that we would have a new hearing another day and be able to get input from you. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2909 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2448. And we have John Moulton and Larry Kirkwood. And I wonder if it would make sense for to get both of those up together here because of the limitations on time.
Question is that do not
In whatever order, gentlemen, makes most sense to you.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Bowersox. The intent here would be to have Mr. Kirkwood and Mr. Moulton testify on matters that directly reflect them. Mr. Barron and I are here to answer any technical questions about the bill, if we may.
Very good.
Okay, I have a problem, and I've come here today to ask for your help. I cannot get access to the Oregon courts because of a glitch in the law. House Bill 2448 will help me and other Oregonians who are caught in this loophole. Like Annie, I need you to act so I and others like me can have our day in court, our day to hold the pharmaceutical company who made Vioxx responsible for the damage it has caused me and thousands like me. In July 2002, my wife and I moved from the Oregon coast to our new home in Molalla, Oregon, about 100 miles inland. On July 18th, 2 weeks later, I awoke and found that I could not walk and fell several times in quick succession. I had heard of strokes and suspected that was my problem, but I could not believe it. I'd always enjoyed good health and, in fact, had passed an annual flight physical each year since 1946 with normal vital signs and no signs of cardiovascular distress. An ambulance was called and took me to the Oregon City Hospital, where I spent the next 4 days being observed by MRI, CAT scan, and several other mechanisms. After lengthy evaluation, I was told I had suffered from a stroke. I have spent my last 4.5 years of my life attempting to recover. My physical recovery has been slow, painful, and limited in results. Before my stroke, I was in great demand as an aircraft certification expert with a proven record as project engineer for the Lockheed L-1011, Boeing 727, and Aerospace Lines G201 Super Guppy. Because of my stroke, the FAA has grounded me after 50 accident-free and infraction-free years of flying with a commercial pilot certificate, further limiting the possibility of employment in aviation. I have lost my house because of huge medical bills, and my income has been reduced to zero except for a small government retirement. For the 2 years immediately prior to my stroke, I was taking Vioxx for an inflamed muscle in my lower abdomen. At the time of my July 2002 stroke, no one suggested that Vioxx might be involved since the medical profession had no knowledge of a possible connection. Since that time, it has been revealed that Merck knew of the increased risk of stroke from using Vioxx but did not tell doctors or the FDA. The connection between strokes and Vioxx became known when Vioxx was withdrawn from the market in the fall of 2004. I immediately sought legal representation. Imagine my shock when my lawyer told me that I could not have my day in court. Oregon law took away my right to seek justice before I even knew that I had a claim. Please fix this injustice. Oregon citizens need you to help them protect the most basic and fundamental right. This is all I ask, the right to have my day in court.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkwood. Let's hear from Mr. Moulton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Moulton. I live in Eugene. I'm represented in Salem by Phil Barnhart and Bill Morissette. I'm 45 years old, and I teach at the College of Business, Oregon State University. And in 1999, 10 weeks after taking my first prescription of Vioxx, I suffered a heart attack. I was lucky that I was able to be given emergency angioplasty and a stent was placed in my heart, but that stent will be with me for the rest of my life. I'm here in support of Bill 2448 and also 2909 to talk to you about the injustices we see face as Oregonians in looking into our claims against firms like Merck. The issue came to light for me far too late. It appears that the statute of ultimate repose also is an issue for me now, as we have deferred this bill from its previous hearing 2 years ago. I am now 7 years from the event, and as we look to go to court, this may become a large issue in my case. But nonetheless, the COX-2 inhibitors and those who are suffered from that are barred from going to court and are unable to seek the justice they're looking for. It may not be a case in which I'm looking only for economic damages. I am also impacted with my family. Because of my heart attack, I am no longer able to seek adequate medical coverage. I am no longer able to get life insurance. And for most Oregonians, that is a basic right and ability that we share and look to gain each of ourselves. I strongly encourage you to support this bill. I look for its passage. As I was here in front of the Senate 2 years ago testifying about a similar bill, I support that in again this hearing today. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And it's just been brought to my attention that the clock on the wall is actually a little slow, probably as a result of the change in time. So we are right at 10:30 and due on the floor. And so, members, if there's just a passing question, we could handle it. But otherwise, I think we need to resume hearings on both of these bills because they raise, I think, substantial issues that need more attention. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. And we will carry over the work session until tomorrow for House Bill 2179. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2448. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can finish today. Thank you very much, committee. We're adjourned.